Into the Fold is a podcast on mental health issues, produced by the Haug Foundation for Mental Health. The Haug Foundation is a strategic grant maker based at the University of Texas at Austin. To learn more, visit us at hogg.utexas.edu. In 2018, the Trump administration lowered the U.S. refugee admission cap to 45,000, the lowest since the enactment of the Refugee Act of 1980. In 2019, the cap was lowered again to just 30,000. Even at this historically low cap, the rate of successful resettlement will almost certainly fail to keep pace with the need. In looking at the situation, one can't help but be struck by how rapidly the situation keeps changing. As the administration continues to redefine the status of refugees in the U.S., seemingly making new rules on the fly, the chaos and uncertainty only further undermines what fragile sense of safety this population already has. Then there's the increasingly hostile and xenophobic political climate in the U.S., which is a crisis all its own. Refugees have a lot to teach us about resilience. Amid all the uncertainty, they work hard to maintain family and community ties, keep up their optimism, and look after their physical and mental health. Our guest today, Dr. Sophia Banu, is a psychiatrist and founder of the Clinic for International Trauma Survivors in Houston, Texas. She has extensive experience working with torture survivors and refugees from countries all over the world. She's fluent in many languages, including English, Tibetan, Nepali, Urdu, and Hindi. She is joining us remotely from Houston. Sophia, thank you for joining us.
Sure. I'm happy to be here.
First, Sophia, tell us about your background and the Clinic for International Trauma Survivors. How did it get started and what is its mission?
So my grandparents had to leave their country in the 1950s and had to resettle in India as refugees because they were not allowed to practice their religion. I started my work with refugees right after medical school, not really, knowing what I was getting into. I was on vacation in Nepal when I met a friend of mine who was a social worker. And she told me that she works with women and men who've been tortured, and women specifically who've been raped, but they will not go see a male doctor because of cultural issues. They won't even go see a doctor. And so she said, "You're a female physician. You've just finished. Why don't you join us?" And just like that, I started working with survivors of torture in Nepal with Bhutanese refugees. And since then, I have not turned back. I came to the U.S. and I started working with the NYU Bellevue Program for Survivors of Torture as a volunteer, then as a fellow, then as faculty. Then I moved to Houston where I joined Baylor. And when I joined them, I asked them if I could please start a clinic for survivors of torture and refugees, since I knew at that time that the numbers were increasing. This was like 10 years ago. And they said, sure. And so I wanted to train residents and medical students. So since 2010, I have been running this clinic for international trauma survivors under Harris Health System and Baylor College of Medicine. So that's how it started, basically.
So let's define some basic terms. Could you characterize for us who is encompassed by the term refugee? And what exactly does the term resettlement mean from a legal perspective?
Sure. So in order to understand the term refugees, we need to go back to the Second World War. The United Nations General Assembly, started the UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And they are the ones who defined who a refugee is and what kind of entitlement is social and legal protection that the country that takes them in is supposed to provide for the refugees. So a refugee in the term, the definition, is someone who's forced to flee his or her country based on war, violence, and persecution, and that they cannot return under any condition back to their country because they might be persecuted because they belong to a certain group, to a political affiliation or even belonging to a certain group in the community or in the country, that they cannot return back. And so two things to keep in mind is they were forced to leave their country, and the second thing is that they cannot return back. So that's the really the basic term. There are lots of other terms. We use migrants, we use internally displaced population, asylum seekers. So all of those, sort of once they are granted a refugee's status, then they're entitled to what a refugee is entitled to from that country. The term resettlement is very, it's a long drawn out process. I think a lot of people here and everywhere, I think, because I give this kind of talk a lot, and I'm surprised when I ask them, what do you think resettlement means and how long does it take? So resettlement is, some people think, there's conflict in my country and I leave my country and I go to the bordering neighboring country. And I'm a refugee and I want to be resettled in the U.S. That's not how it works. Once you leave your country or you're forced to leave your country. So for instance, let's talk about Syria. If a Syrian refugee, a Syrian person leaves Syria and goes to Turkey in a refugee camp, there they have to register with the UNHCR, and UNHCR will then say, okay, you are going to be resettled if you belong to four vulnerable categories. If you're an unaccompanied child, if you're a woman and a child at risk, if you have severe medical issues, and if you've been a victim of torture in your country. So those are the four categories that a person can be entitled to resettlement. So UNHCR will do iris scans, biographic data, facial scans, before US or Canada or Australia will say, okay, I want to resettle 20 people from Bhutan, or I want to resettle 30 people from Syria. So once they are chosen by the country in the United States, they have to go through 8 security databases, 6 background checks, 5 separate security databases, and 3 in-person interviews before that person gets on a plane and comes to the Houston airport to be picked up by a resettlement agency case manager. And this process I can take from a minimum of 2 years to a maximum of 20 plus years. For instance, let me give you an example. When I was working in Nepal with the Bhutanese survivors of torture, this was like 25 years ago, I've been here in the US for about 15 to 20 years now. I used to work there. And then when I moved to Houston, I had refugees from Bhutan coming in and I was seeing them in my clinic. So it's taken them that long. And some of the refugees that I see in my clinic, they were born in the refugee camp. And that's all they knew. That's all they've ever known before coming to the country of resettlement.
So we hear a lot these days about the worsening circumstances at our southern border. But what do you think our listeners need to know about the environment for people seeking asylum and refugee now?
Well, it's very sad what you hear every day on the news about what's happening at the border and all over the world. But what I would like to, I'm hoping it'll get better. And yesterday I was reading something where they said one of the detention centers was being cleared of all the children. I'm hoping that's true, that they're being moved to families or people who want to give them shelter. But I really want our audience to know that the Physicians for Human Rights, I started a student chapter at Baylor College of Medicine under myself, Dr. Stoller and Dr. Fredericks, the 3 faculty members. We have started an asylum clinic. It's called the Human Rights Asylum Clinic under Baylor College of Medicine, where we provide free forensic evaluations for anybody seeking asylum.
Okay.
This is really needed, much needed. And it's also, so anybody who needs asylum should contact Physicians for Human Rights or have their lawyers contact Physicians for Human Rights, and the Physicians for Human Rights will contact us. So we have the clinic once a month, It's at Alliance, and we have volunteer faculty who will do the evaluations. We have medical students who will help us do the scribe, and they're the ones who run the clinic, but we supervise them. Okay. So I think if there's anybody in need, and it doesn't have to be from Houston, you know, you could have an asylum seeker in Dallas, Austin, Fort Worth, wherever in Texas. If they need help, we are here. We one Saturday a month, we have lots of volunteers who've been trained by Physicians for Human Rights in order to, you know, to do a good job of writing an evaluation so they can help the cases. The other thing for our audience to know is once an asylum seeker gets asylum, we hope that most of them will get asylum, is that they are granted a refugee status. And once they are granted refugee status, then they can get some help. Like any other refugees who come into the United States through UNHCR, they're entitled to the same kind of services that a refugee has. So whether you're a victim of human trafficking, asylum seeker who's gotten asylum, or a parolee from Cuba or Haiti, you are entitled to services that a refugee gets when you reach Houston or whichever city you are in. So you can get Medicaid, paying rent for the first 3 months, English language services, driver's education, employment assistance. So all of those you're entitled to once you're granted asylum.
Okay. So what is the current size of the refugee population in Texas? And how would you characterize the level of need for mental health supports for this population versus the availability?
I think the size, I don't think, you know, I've tried asking people what is the exact number of refugees, and nobody can give me the correct answer. And the reason is it's an ever-evolving number, you know, as the number changes with the number of parolees from Cuba, Haiti, asylum seekers. If they get asylum, then they're included in the number. But if they haven't gotten asylum, then they're not included in the number. If you're a victim of human trafficking, fighting a case, you haven't been included in the number. But what I do know is that the number has decreased drastically. And I think you mentioned that in the beginning when you were doing the introduction of how the numbers have gone down. So just to give you an example, in between October of 2016 to March of 2017, Texas had 3,518 refugees. And the following year, from October 2017 to March 2018, there were only 736 refugees. It's the lowest number since 1970s, 1980s. That's what the number is. So again, it changes as, you know, the number of asylum seekers, victim of human trafficking, and the refugees themselves are added. I think as far as mental health support, there are some clinics that offer mental health support to, refugees and asylum seekers who have no insurance. There may be sliding scale, there may be, Harris Health, for instance, has, if you meet the eligibility criteria, you can get a eligibility card where you can get services for a minimum amount of fees. Most of the resettlement agencies have caseworkers who will take the refugees to whichever clinic they are zoned to or provide services. But personally, the clinic that I run for Clinic for International Trauma Survivors, I specifically only treat refugees and survivors of torture at Ben Taub and Harris Health. And recently I joined Alliance, which is one of the resettlement agencies in Houston, to start a refugee clinic one half day a week, where again I see refugees and survivors of torture for mental health issues and supportive therapy and medication management. I know that USCRI is working to create a database of services that refugees can avail of for mental health support. So I think we have Ibn Sina, Shifa Clinic. We also have Legacy Clinics, Hope Clinics. So all of these in Houston that I know provide services to refugees. But the need is always greater than the availability. And the other thing, if I may just elaborate a little bit, Ike, is that I may be sitting in my clinic and I'm expecting to see Mr. So-and-so, you know, but I'm in my clinic and he's at home and there's no way for him to get from his home to my clinic. That's another obstacle. Yeah. That's another problem that, you know, we can talk about that later. But even though we're here, sometimes it's connecting the dots is what's more difficult at times.
So what are some characteristics of this population that might surprise people or defy stereotypes?
I'm glad you asked me this question. Because there are lots of misconceptions about refugees and lots of myths about refugees that I really want to clear up. So what we need to know this for sure, that less than 1% of refugees apply for disability. And disability, they usually want to apply when, you know, they cannot walk or they cannot get out of the house for whatever reason, you know. So that's one thing. Because I know in the past, people have thought that, oh my God, the refugees are coming and they're going to drain us. The economy is going to go downhill. And this is far from the truth. Most of the refugees, I would say 90% or 95% of the refugees who come to the United States and the ones that I've been working with want to work. They want to work. They want to learn the language. They want to provide for their families and they want to move forward. So that's one thing. The other thing is, you know, the dangers of having a refugee. Like I said earlier, the resettlement process, nobody is vetted more than a refugee that arrives in the United States. So even though we've had 3 million refugees since 1975 in the United States, not a single lethal terrorist attack has been committed by a refugee. So that's one thing. The other thing is, according to the Department of Human and Health Services, refugees added a total of $63 billion to the economy. And a refugee between the age of 18 to 40, I think, 18 to 40, 18 to late 30s, have contributed $20,000+ in taxes over and above the amount that person got as a refugee, like in the benefits, you know, how much of a benefit they got. They paid $20,000 more in taxes.
Sophia, what can you tell us about your therapeutic approach and how it is ideally suited for this particular population?
My therapeutic approach is I train residents, psychiatry residents, I train child psychiatry fellows, and I also work with medical students. I always tell them, first and foremost, to the person who's sitting in front of you is another human being. Forget about where they're from or who they are. It's he or she is a human being in front of you. To treat them like a human being. Treat them like you would want them yourself to be treated. That's one thing. The other thing that I always stress is this person who's sitting in front of you has probably lost control of everything in their lives. They've lost their homes. They've lost family members. They're in a new country where they don't understand the language. They're in a new country where the climate is completely different. They're in a new country where they don't even know how to cross the street. Sometimes I've had refugees who have had difficulty crossing the street because there were three intersections, you know. So I think one really, really important thing is to make them, empower them, you know, give them the control of the session and say, whatever it is that you want to talk about, you know, empower them by giving them the power in their hands to say, you know, you've lost control of everything. This is where you can do whatever you want. Like you can talk about whatever it is that you want, and not to lay down rules and say, oh, let's see if you meet criteria for PTSD. Let's see if you have major depression. Let's see what medication you need. You know, all of that can come later. But when they're with you, you try to create a safe place for them to feel safe, for them to verbalize their emotions, for them to verbalize the difficulties. And, you know, just by listening sometimes, it can go such a long way, making them feel like, I want to hear what you have to tell me, what you have to share. Making them feel important, making them feel like I'm another person who wants to know what happened to you and to empathize with you. I think no matter what kind of therapy you do, and I know there are lots of therapies out there, you know, there's trauma-informed care, which is really, really excellent. You can do supportive therapy. You can do trauma-focused CBT. You can do EMDR. But at the end of the day, I think it's the relationship that you have with the person sitting in front of you is the most important healing tool for them.
Okay.
All of those therapies are really effective. And, you know, you have narrative exposure therapy. You have, you know, like lots of therapies out there. But I think when you form a relationship with the person in front of you, I think that is the biggest, I think, for me at least, the healing tool for my clients.
Okay, wow. Thank you for that. I would love to get some personal stories about your experiences working with refugees. Is there anything that you care to share that would help us to understand the experience of a refugee a little better?
So I have so many cases. so let me, and I know if people have heard me talk about refugees before, this is one of the cases that I always talk about. So this was when I first started working with refugees and survivors of torture in Nepal. I was documenting torture survivor cases for Amnesty International. And remember, I was really, really young and very innocent at that time. So I was documenting, and I was also treating, you know, mild ailments like frostbite. This was for people who had walked through the mountains to come into Nepal. And then there were Tibetans who were moving forward onto India to visit the Dalai Lama to get an audience with the Dalai Lama. So this was a young nun who had been tortured severely because she had taken part in a demonstration. And so I was treating her frostbite because she'd walked through the mountains. And I was also, you know, documenting what had happened to her. And while she was telling me the way she was tortured, I was getting upset, you know, really, really angry and upset. And I had to stop. And I said, my God, they're such horrible people. How dare they do that to you? You must be so angry. And, you know, and she just looked at me and sort of half a smile. And she said, no, actually, I'm not angry at them. I actually feel sorry for them because they were born to do such evil things. And she said, I pray that in their next life, you know, Buddhists believe in rebirth, in the next life, that they will be born with a better karma, that they will be born, reborn as better human beings, that she was praying for them. And, you know, it completely took me by surprise. And I always talk about this case. This was one of the first cases that I actually has left an impact on me. And since then, I haven't turned back on this journey. So compassion, stories like, I mean, if you have time, I mean, I know we don't have time right now, but there are so many stories like this where compassion, kindness, helping others. I hear these stories all every day, every week that I am with working with refugees.
So when someone is looking for a culturally competent therapist or provider of some sort, what advice do you give to them? And where can people turn for this sort of thing?
So there is, I know for the past few years, people have been talking about culturally competent care and providers, but now we're sort of moving towards cultural humility. So I think we're moving away from culturally competent therapy to practicing cultural humility while you do providing culturally competent care, where, you know, you are with the person and the person is the one who's an expert in his or her culture, and you are the one who's learning. Whatever you have, whatever degrees you have is on the side. But what you're learning from the person sitting in front of you, and then you work with them in providing the best help possible. So it's not that, you know, you need to be an expert in the other person's culture, but while you're in session, you will learn things from him or her that you can then use to provide care.
So I'm really glad that you said that, because The Hogg Foundation is pretty big on making it clear that there's a lot more to cultural competency than just being able to speak the language, you know, and that there's, in fact, a next level of sophistication and really nuance, you know, when it comes to how we think culturally competent should be defined.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. We all should try to do that, because I think a lot of people out there who haven't worked, who have worked, but who, you know, they think, oh, providing culturally competent care, which is good. I mean, I'm not saying that's necessarily negative. That is really good. But I think learning from the person sitting in front of you is what will help you in your treatment with them.
So what can people do who want to help this population?
Okay, so that's a million-dollar question. There's so much one can do, you know, from, I think, volunteering with resettlement agencies, going to the airport. I mean, I know the numbers decreased drastically, but there are a few arrivals to the airport to welcome new refugees or to welcome asylum seekers. You know, there are organizations in Houston that I know that some of them prepare the apartment with like basic furniture. Oh my God, helping with transportation. Like I was saying earlier, you know, I'm sitting in my clinic and the person that I wanted to see or has an appointment with me is sitting in his or her apartment and there's no way for me to connect. Helping with transportation, attending refugee conferences that, you know, you can help us with the languages that you speak. Advocacy for refugees and asylum seekers with your local offices. I think those go a long way. Like, I mean, it doesn't have to be a lot. It doesn't have to be complicated. Let me just give you an example. Like, because I had a few friends who wanted to donate furniture. And I know, you know, and the furnitures were, you know, slightly used, of course, but a refugee, new coming refugee, would have really benefited from them. But I couldn't find anybody to pick up the furniture from my friend's house and to take it to a warehouse. And it was really frustrating because there was nothing I could do, you know, so really, really simple things like that. I think people can do a lot, create an organization like a, just say an organization to help refugees with furniture, like a right. Really basic thing that can be done if you have the right connect, if you have the, not right, if you have the connections. I think a lot can be done.
Okay. And then specifically those who are interested in the mental health front, are there any opportunities there?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I have done with Baylor College of Medicine and Alliance, where Alliance pays for half a day to Baylor for me to work at the agency itself. Providers who want to do that with other agencies, but I think that goes a long way, Ike, because when I'm sitting at Alliance and treating patients, clients, you know, people who need help, they're already at the agency, right? Some of them. Because the agency provides other help, right? Like whether it's food stamp or you have a medical appointment or you're there to fill out or English classes. So they're already there. So the distance between the person who's helping and the person who needs help is shortened because they're already at the agency. And if I'm there, then I say, oh, why don't you come in and let's chat about what you're doing, you know? I do a lot of work in the community where I go to apartment complexes and we provide wellness education classes to the refugee women. And each, you know, like 3-4 months, we do Afghani women, then we do Congolese women, then we try to do Iraqi women in the community. And you can supervise the medical students. If you are in Austin and if you want to work with a medical school in Austin, you can create a group of medical students who want to work with refugees, and I can provide, you know, manuals that they can use that are refugee friendly. And you as a mental health provider can supervise them. So just basic education about you know, OB issue or obstetric issue, gynecologic issue, mental health, you know, what to do about mental health, childcare. Like, we do parenting classes also sometimes on Saturdays for refugee women who have asked us for parenting classes. So there are lots of things that you can do. I mean, I'm more than open to having people contact me if they're looking for ideas.
So we have about reached the end of our interview. Dr. Sophia Banu, thank you so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. And we think that this conversation, you know, will be a milestone as far as, you know, just the work that you've done for us to really close the gap in people's understanding about this pretty critical issue. And so we really appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure, you're welcome. And can I just add one last thing? So you have to, oh my God, your life, and I talk for myself, when I'm with refugees and, you know, in session with them, when I hear the stories and what they're doing and how they've overcome them, it makes me stronger. So if you want to, like the Dalai Lama, if you want to be happy, practice compassion. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. But one thing to keep in mind is when you're working with refugees, not all of them are, you know, like suffering as in PTSD, depression, yeah, or adjustment or whatever. A lot of refugees have post-traumatic growth. And that's another thing that we are focusing on, than the positive aspect of somebody who's been through a lot of trauma, but has come out stronger on the other side. I mean, research, yeah, has shown that 1/3 of people who undergo trauma become worse, 1/3 stay the same, and 1/3 get better. Spiritually, emotionally, physically, they become stronger, and then they want to do more with because of what they've experienced. So there's a lot of post-traumatic growth. Of course, resilience is there for sure in children and in adults, but post-traumatic growth is also another thing that we want to focus on and try to educate and create awareness.
Right. And thank you for that, because I actually think that that's hugely important. One of the benefits of working with this population is not just the opportunity to make a difference, but also to get inspired. So I think it's actually good that you added that part. Dr. Sophia Banu, good luck with everything. And thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
We have done other episodes on the experience of migrants. To give you a taste, here is a snippet from episode 45, my interview with Dr. Louise Zayas of the Steve Hicks School of Social Work on the topic of deportation anxiety for young adults.
I admire the fact that they are speaking up, they are banding together, they are making themselves known. But it doesn't take away the fact that many of them worry about themselves, worry about their parents. Because if they're undocumented, chances are their parents are undocumented, but many of their younger siblings are U.S. citizens.
You can find links to this and to other related content in the description for this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.